Hello, welcome to episode 7 of All Songs Are Love Songs, the podcast in which I, Rowan, try to convince Judge Erica and you that all songs ever written qualify as love songs. In each episode, guests will bring songs as evidence to prove me wrong. In this episode, Lee speaks to us from lockdown in England.
That this gibberish composition is designed to entertain with its humour.
And speaking to us from hotel quarantine in Sydney, it's James Robertson.
Confusion does not equal love. I mean, how could we possibly think that this is a love song when we don't even know what the song is actually about?
That's all coming up on this episode. So, let's step back into the courtroom.
All songs, love songs, love songs.
First up, let's hear from Lee Mason. It's time for another challenge. Back to the courtroom with Judge Erica presiding.
Order. Order in a court.
When did you get a gavel?
That sounds like none of your business. Hello. Good morning, defense, prosecution. Good day, gallery. Welcome. Today, as the prosecution, we have Lee Mason. Welcome to the courtroom.
Thank you so much, Judge Erica. It's a pleasure to be back.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you. How are you feeling? Walk us through where your brain is at this morning.
Oh, gladly. I'm doing well. I'm over here in England, over in the UK, currently in our second lockdown. So with a lot of extra time on my hands, I decided to pick a fight with one of my good friends, Mr. Rowan Windle.
What a fantastic thing to do in your second lockdown. I absolutely appreciate that. For anyone that hasn't yet experienced you on the podcast, can you just tell us a little bit about what expertise you are bringing to the court?
Oh, absolutely. Hello, listeners. My name's Lee Mason, widely known as Lee, your cruise director to the carnival cruising masses. I've worked in entertainment for quite a while now, and my background was in theater. I studied acting and musical theater, and that is based heavily around the interpretation of the written form, storytelling, and all of that good stuff. And I believe at the essence of every great song, there is a fantastic message or story. And thus, I am qualified to tell you exactly why these songs are not love songs.
Lee, please tell us what song you have brought into evidence today.
The song in question, Judge Erica, is Axel F. by The Crazy Frog, formerly known as The Annoying Thing.
Bing, bing.
Oh, this is going to be a good one.
Erica, are you familiar? Would you like to hear the song?
No, I'm very familiar. I worked at a nightclub for 7 years. I know this song. Oh, goodness. All right. Prosecution, please, Lee, tell us why Axel F. is not a love song.
With great pleasure. Now, in my opening, I would like to highlight that the defense has a known history of bombarding the court with research and loosely related so-called evidence. And as they say, if you can't beat them, join them. So to begin with, let's get the backstory of our protagonist, the artist in question. Who is the crazy frog? And is he indeed in love and ring-ding-dinging as a cry of heartfelt passion or romance? To answer that question, we have to go back to 1997. A 17-year-old Swedish student named Daniel Malmedal recorded himself imitating the noise produced by a two-stroke engine. Those bim bim bims are actually supposed to be a motorbike. He posted it online, and as with all good things, it got the attention of a lot of people. He ended up on TV. He did his bim bimming on TV, and subsequently it took the internet by storm. The sound was adopted as a Formula One car as early as 2001. It appeared on the internet with a piece called Deng Deng Form, or later The Insanity Test, both of which featured a static background of a Ferrari team Formula One car accompanied by his two-stroke engine impression. In late 2003, another Swede, interestingly, Erik Wernquist, he encountered the sound effect and was inspired to create a CGI animation of a creature floating, and he called it The Annoying Thing and used the original sound clip to accompany it. Now, the creature that was created is our protagonist, the googly-eyed, manic-looking creature, soon to be dubbed the Crazy Frog. The animation received a lot of attention on file sharing, peer-to-peer networks, and word of mouth. And before you know it, it was actually used for a ringtone. A European ringtone producer got the rights to it, and they renamed this animation, formerly The Annoying Thing, to be now, as we know him, The Crazy Frog. He had a number one hit that we were all plagued by, and in bringing this song to light here in the court today, I'm sure people shudder in that memory. What they may not know, though, is its original creator said that if he had known it was going to be such a big thing, he wouldn't have allowed them to use the stupid name because it's got nothing to do with the character. It's not even a frog, and it's not particularly crazy, just to set the record straight there. Following the success of the ringtone, the song was described as a novelty number one hit. So let's look at the word novelty. It's a noun denoting an object intended to be amusing as a result of its unusual design. Therefore, I would argue that the popular opinion would be that this gibberish composition is designed to entertain with its humor. And that is the essence, humor, not a single romantic notion. If you want to look a little further into our character, because of course, there's no lyrical analysis. I took the lyrics from this song and I put it through Google Translate, and they don't even know what it means in any language. So let's look at the story that's told in the music video. The frog, presented as a felon on the run from a bounty hunter, he rides an invisible motorbike. He bim-bim-bims his way through a landscape, but there is no element of love, romance, or passion. There's no love interest. He isn't bim-bimming to try and win the heart of another crazy amphibian. In closing, I looked online for song meanings to see if anybody had decoded the gibberish that is spouted by our little amphibious friend. And I came across the following statement posted by message board user Nozzle Switch on May the 7th, 2009. To quote Nozzle Switch directly, he says, "I do not like this song. It is the worst song in the world. It means nothing. It just wants to annoy people. And they did a good job because that's what it did to me. So if you like this song, you have messed up ears." The song also was number one, deservedly, in the most annoying songs of all time, beating the Teletubbies, the Birdie Song, and Billy Ray Cyrus's Achy Breaky Heart. Judge Erica, with all things considered, and the popular opinion being that this song is a novelty number one hit and the most annoying song of all time, I rest my case.
Wow. Gallery defense. I feel like we just went through something together.
Civilization.
Wow. All right. I will hold my comments until we are done. Defense, Rowan, please tell the court why this is a love song.
I would absolutely love to. Firstly, Lee, thank you for your impeccable background research. I really appreciate that. You've saved me from running through the timeline of Crazy Frog. That is absolutely brilliant. And you did a fantastic job with your research. There are some comments in there that you made which are accurate, but which I found really entertaining. The bit where he says the frog's not particularly crazy. I love that. Because it does look like a frog, let's be honest. It does look like a frog. And it's pretending to ride a motorbike. If I saw a frog pretending to ride a motorbike, I would be like, crazy. So I think it is a particularly crazy frog. So that's not an issue with your research. That's just with what the creator was saying. Since you're quoting random people on message boards on the internet, I will get to do that too. I didn't write this one down as I passed it, but I noted one internet forum user writing, "I have enjoyed this song over the years with my children as a family." So, yeah, some people like it, some people don't. And I really enjoyed that at the end in your summary, you compared it to other love songs like Achy Breaky Heart, which is definitely a love song. So thank you for that also. You'll be happy to know on Spotify, Crazy Frog has over 1 million monthly listeners, and there's a new album in development as of this year. So album, Crazy Hits, which included the iconic Axel F, which is the remix of Beverly Hills Cop, falls under a genre called happy hardcore, which is possibly also a category on porn websites, I'm not sure. When that came out in 2005, it outsold Coldplay's new album, 4-1 in the UK. That's how popular it was at the time. Not everybody liked it. Malcolm McLaren, for one, he wrote, "Listen to this song and you can hear the death knell of the traditional music industry. But since the music industry is alive today, we can assume this was either a rebirth or the music industry simply persevered." One commentator wrote, "Vocal brilliance is initially reminiscent of emergency service sirens, but can also be seen as a clear reference to the call to prayer. Both of these are elements of love, the desire to spend a life helping others or giving oneself to a period of devotion, which, while it's not for everyone, is definitely a form of love." In spite of its detractors, Crazy Frog was also a pioneer of marketing. Memorable, catchy, grabbing attention by any means was why it was used as a ringtone. Now, music, a song, debatable in its original form whether it was a song, but as the remix with the Axel F, definitely. But this is more than a song, it's a sensory experience that makes the listeners experience deep emotion. And though it's been compared to Vegemite, which I love, by the way, as a you know, love-hate comparison, a more accurate metaphor is that of a Christmas cracker of songs. A song designed to unite people through either direct enjoyment or shared derision. Either way is fine. And like a well-designed Christmas cracker, it uses our sense of humour and fun to deepen our love for each other. And at the time, it was so very funny. In popular British TV show The Inbetweeners, when Jay is told by a girl, "Go on, make me laugh," what's his go-to? Crazy Frog. It appeals to people's inner child, the fun, silly part of us that just wants to make annoying noises with our mouths. Silly noises, laughter, these are visceral things that bring us to our simplest level of pleasure, like an auditory version of playing in mud, releasing dopamine. Sure, it's annoying when you're not the person doing it, but what pure joy and love for the inner child in these activities. That is why, as a vehicle for the pleasure centers of the brain, this is so obviously a love song. I rest my case.
All songs are love songs. All songs are love songs. All songs are love songs.
Wow. Gentlemen, you've both presented incredible arguments today. Lee, as the prosecution, you are entitled to 30 seconds of rebuttal. Would you care to use that now?
I would be delighted to rebuttal the points that were just beautifully and eloquently laid out. You will understand as soon as I hold this mirror up to you that the defense focused on people's love of the song and, of course, a shared love of silliness and frivolity. But at no point did he actually say that this song has love at its essence. In my opinion, I would say that anybody that interprets this song as a love song is merely projecting their own narrative and their own passions on what can only be described as a nonsense piece that is masterfully crafted to tiptoe the line of utter annoyance and being an incredibly catchy earworm. But there is no scrap of love or passion within this song.
Gentlemen, you've both given me a lot to think about. I was sold when Lee talked about the two-stroke engine, the origins of the sound of the song. I was not aware of that. I don't know if the gallery was. I quite like it. Rowan, you had me with dopamine and the pleasure center of the brain. That is a very fascinating concept. However, Lee made an excellent rebuttal point in that it noises and things that stimulate your brain doesn't necessarily mean that the song itself has an origin of love. Therefore, judge's rule, this is not a love song.
Bam! No!
Bam, bam.
Yes!
Yes, I did it. I feel like my life's work is complete.
Oh, no.
I would like to dedicate this win to Boris Johnson and the time that he's given me to sit in my house and ponder this. Thank you.
So it's redemption for Lee and three losses in a row for me. In a moment, James will do his best to make that four. Before we jump into that, I'd like to shout out to other podcasts that I listen to every week. Lee, who you just heard here, has a show called Tea with Lee, in which he chats with guests, mostly from the cruise industry, which is still currently on pause. It's often hilarious and brings back memories of simpler times on the high seas with wonderful people. One of his episodes soon will feature our very own Erica. Another show I subscribe to is Unfortunate History, in which our friend Cody Pennington dissects a variety of fascinating and, well, unfortunate events and characters from history. He even has an episode about the Great Emu War in Australia. Unfortunate History is very entertaining and well-researched. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. On with the show.
I have the army and I think a few security guards sitting outside my hotel room.
Oh, that's right. You've traveled and now you're facing the consequences.
Yes. Yes, I am in quarantine.
Yes, quarantine.
Well, that means we have more time for us. So let's look at the right side. Defense, prosecution, gallery, welcome. And in the courtroom today, we have a new prosecution. Can I please introduce to everyone James Robertson? How are you today?
Hello, Judge Erica.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling okay. I'm feeling nervous. I've listened to all the episodes, you know. I know Rowan as an excellent orator, so, you know, let's see how we go.
All right. So what expertise are you bringing to the courtroom today? Why should the gallery believe your argument?
Well, Judge, I'm not sure if you know this, but one time I almost completed 50% of a law degree.
That is an interesting fact.
Was there anything else you'd like to know?
Well, I'm astounded. You're the most qualified person we've had on.
You're more qualified than I am. Let's get right to it. What song are you presenting as evidence today, James?
Today, the absolute classic Humpty Dumpty.
Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again.
Oh, I am very excited about this one. And I think this afternoon the court will hear the arguments from the prosecution first. Please, James, tell the court why Humpty Dumpty is not a love song.
Okay. If it please the court, that's something I learned in my 50% of law school. I'm here today to convince you that Humpty Dumpty, the children's nursery rhyme, but is it? Maybe it's a riddle. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a song. It could be a poem from a late 19th century musical or pantomime from Broadway. It's maybe based on a clumsy anthropomorphic egg, maybe based on Richard III, maybe based on Cardinal Wolsey, the arrogant, power-grabbing almoner of Henry VIII, who lived in a non-canonical marriage. Maybe it's based on an old piece of military equipment from the 17th century that was ultimately not fit for purpose, or maybe it was a cannon that fell out of a castle. I'm here to convince you that a song about any of those things couldn't possibly be a love song. It's confusing and it's bland and it's merely a practical song. Now, we don't need to analyze the words too much to find no evidence of love. There is no love in these words. They're purely utilitarian. For example, there's nothing in the song that says all the king's horses and all the king's men were devastated that they couldn't put Humpty together again. They simply couldn't. No emotion, no love. And there's certainly no indication that Humpty was in some way looking for love or in love. He just simply sat on the wall and then he simply had a great fall. Nothing in between, dry and factual. And again, if the lyrics were Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall looking for his sweetheart across the sprawl, then there'd be no debate. But they aren't the words. And, you know, Even if we aren't talking about, so that was about romantic love. Let's talk about something else. What about love of a thing or an action? Like, you know, I love breakfast. Some people love a good nap. Some people love the sound of their own voice, and I worry that may quickly be becoming one of them. Well, there's no indication that Humpty loves sitting on that wall. There's no indication that Humpty loves the wall. He's simply sitting on it until he falls, nothing more, nothing less, nothing in between. And the whole thing is very confusing. I'm confused about what Humpty even is or what this song is about. Love can be confusing, but it doesn't work both ways. Confusion does not equal love. I mean, how could we possibly think that this is a love song when we don't even know what the song is actually about? Even the list of potential subjects that the song is about doesn't throw up many possibilities. The historical figures, Richard III, Henry VIII, Cardinal Wolsey, are symbols of hate, lust, power, and corruption. They're not characters associated with love. And what about the weapons? Sure, some people love weapons, but these were not weapons that were love. They were weapons that failed, supposedly functional objects that ultimately served no function. I mean, and what about the most common depiction, an egg? An egg with eyes and a mouth and arms and legs. I get it. You might love eggs. But do you love an egg? What happens if an egg falls? You get annoyed. You realize you can't put it together again. You clean it up and you replace it with another egg. You forget it and you feel nothing. No love. I rest my case.
That's James. That's compelling arguments.
So good.
A lot of things. I've got a lot to think about. I have to reevaluate my entire childhood. Rowan, please, for the defense, tell us why Humpty Dumpty is a love song.
Thank you, Your Honor. James, you bring up a lot of really good points there. Is it a riddle? Is it a poem? Is it a song? Is it a Broadway play? Let me give you a couple of facts about Humpty Dumpty. It was originally considered the possibility that it was a riddle. That was one of the earlier analyses of it. It's kind of a poem and kind of a song because it's a poem, but people set it to music and sing it as a nursery rhyme. It was, from 1869 to 1881, Humpty Dumpty the pantomime musical held the title of longest-running Broadway show with 483 performances. It's been more than that. In fact, Humpty Dumpty has been used in scientific papers to demonstrate the second law of thermodynamics, which is entropy. There do exist similar rhymes and riddles in different languages, such as bul-bul in French, lil-tril in Sweden and Norway. And in different parts of Germany, they have Runzelken, Punzelken, or Humpelken, Pumpelken, which are different versions of Humpty Dumpty. The earliest known version comes from Samuel Arnold's Juvenile Amusements. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. Fourscore men and fourscore more could not make Humpty Dumpty where he was before. Now, which is slightly different from the modern version. An 1842 version read, Humpty Dumpty lay in a beck, with all his sinews around his neck. 40 doctors and 40 rights couldn't put Humpty Dumpty to rights. So I'm going to come back to that version a little bit later. Because ones like this, the origins become a little obscured and there becomes a lot of speculation about where they come from. The egg theory, we can dismiss that. It's not an egg. It's not no mention of that in the rhyme. Lewis Carroll described the character Humpty Dumpty as a large egg in 1872 in Through the Looking Glass. Since then, it's often been represented as an egg. But that's just something Lewis Carroll added to it. So I think we can dismiss egg theory. In The Secret History of Nursery Rhymes by Linda Olchin, she says Humpty Dumpty was a colloquial term in 15th century England to mean someone who was a beast. The Oxford English Dictionary has Humpty Dumpty as a 17th century term for a drink of brandy boiled with ale. So what's happened so far is the origins have become a little obscured and lots of people have different theories. However, the most plausible and written about theory is the canon one, as James mentioned. According to several war historians, Humpty Dumpty was the nickname of a large cannon used in the 1648 Siege of Colchester during the English Civil War. Attacking cannon fire destroyed the wall under Humpty Dumpty, causing a tumble. And because it was such a large cannon, it was too large for the king's horses and men to put it back together, to put it back up on the wall. So Humpty Dumpty was used by royalists fighting in support of King Charles I, who lost, leading England to be ruled by genocidal maniac Oliver Cromwell. You say it's confusing, James, but I'm going to come to that. It's confusing because it's a metaphor. It's a metaphor. It's bland and practical because it's brief. And it's confusing because it's a metaphor. And I will explain. It's a nursery rhyme. Nursery rhymes often have morals. If we want a moral, surely it's don't sit on walls if you're a cannon. or persistence pays off or something like that, although in this case we see persistence doesn't pay off because they can't get him back up. So we could conclude that this is a loving tribute to a particularly memorable cannon, one of which fell in battle and was so large that it had been affectionately nicknamed for its obesity as Humpty Dumpty. And if you write a rhyme about a beloved cannon that it's so charming and catchy that children still sing it now 370 years later, that could only have been a song written with love. However, this is not the way that I'm going to argue this is a love song. And now, Humpty Dumpty as a metaphor, this is why it's a love song. Okay, now, simmering in our collective subconsciousness, this song is actually about the oldest topic of all time. Let's look behind the curtains. Pioneering psychologists Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung agreed that guns are obvious phallic symbols, representing sexual impulses and ingrained in the archetype of the heroic warrior. Let me just pop back to the 1842 version, all his sinews around his neck. Regarding the king's horses and men, this is a kitchen sink style exaggeration that clearly just means everyone, or at least lots of people. So with this insight now, we have a song about an exceptionally large phallus, which has fallen and cannot, in spite of efforts from numerous people, cannot be raised again. The truth is, this is a song about the frustration of erectile dysfunction, a song about inspiringly large genitalia and the desire for sex. It deserves a place alongside tunes such as Despacito, Push It, and WAP as a tender and explicit love song. I rest my case.
All songs are love songs.
Wow.
Wow.
This court has seen many arguments. Rarely have we seen arguments go from pantomime's third dynamics to Oliver Cromwell and giant genitalia. James, as the prosecution, you are entitled to 30 seconds of rebuttal. Would you care to use that now?
Sure. Absolutely. I don't believe we can dismiss the most widely considered version of Humpty Dumpty in the modern day, which is that he was an egg. I acknowledge the canon, and I go back to my original point that this was not a story of love. This was a story of failure. It was a functional object that ultimately served no function, no love. I also note that the defense read the exact same Wikipedia page that I read in the research for the for this particular case.
Thank you, James.
I rest my case.
I can't help but notice, James, in your rebuttal, that you, in fact, reiterated the defense's statement that it is about something that is now non-functional.
Yeah,
gentlemen, in a courtroom, it's my job to decide if this is or not is a love song or is not a love song. And sometimes I don't know. But today, the argument that has swayed me the hardest is the defense. Humpty Dumpty is a love song.
Yes! Yeah!
Who knew? I think Humpty Dumpty is now officially cancelled.
Yeah. I think we all could use a sip of Humpty Dumpty if it's still a drink.
Well, a big thank you to both of our guests today. That's James Robertson and Lee Mason. Coming up on our next episode, something we have never had before. For the very first time, one of our songs is coming back for a second time in the Court of Appeals. Till then, see you later.
All songs, the love songs.